Okay, good morning, everybody. We're now on the record, and let the record show that it is 9 a.m. on July 30th, 2015. We are present at Teddy's Residential Suites in Watford City, North Dakota, for the public hearing in PSC case number PU-15-137, the matter of the application of One Oak Bakken Pipeline, LLC, for a certificate of corridor compatibility and route permit for a 4-mile, 8-inch diameter natural gas liquids pipeline and associated facilities in McKenzie County, North Dakota. My name is Wade Mann, and I'm the procedural administrative law judge designated to preside over this hearing. Also present today are the members of the Public Service Commission, the Commission's Chair, Julie Fedorchek, Commissioner Randy Christman, and Commissioner Brian Kalk. And I will be calling on a commissioner shortly for opening remarks after we address some of the procedural issues. At this time, I will take appearances for the record, beginning with the applicant. Okay, and Commission Advisory Staff?
Brian Schmidt, appointed Special Assistant Attorney General for the Public Service Commission. And to my right is Julie Prescott, Utility Analyst for the Public Service Commission. Today we will be requesting that Ms. Prescott be able to ask questions.
Okay. Mr. Morrison, any objection?
No objection.
Okay. Ms. Prescott, you can directly examine the witnesses as well. At this time, we'll note the issues to be addressed at today's hearing. With respect to the certificate of corridor compatibility and route permit, there are three issues. Number one, will the location and operation of the proposed facilities produce minimal adverse effects on the environment and upon the welfare of the citizens of North Dakota? Two, are the proposed facilities compatible with the environmental preservation and the efficient use of resources? And three, will the proposed facility locations minimize adverse human and environmental impact while ensuring continuing system reliability and integrity and ensuring that energy needs are met and fulfilled in an orderly and timely fashion? With respect to the hearing, One Oak, the applicant, will present its case first. It will call its witnesses, offer any documentary evidence. Any witnesses called by One Oak will be subject to cross-examination by counsel for Commission Advisory Staff and Ms. Prescott, and also questions from each of the commissioners. Once One Oak completes its case, then if there are any members of the public who would like to come forward and offer any information to the commissioners, they can do so at that time. Any public witnesses will come forward to the table. They'll need to be sworn in just like the other witnesses. And then once you complete your testimony, if you could just remain at the table and allow the attorneys and the commissioners an opportunity to see if they have any questions for you. Are there any questions with respect to procedure before we continue, Mr. Morrison?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Schmidt?
No questions, Your Honor.
Okay. And at this time, we'll take opening comments from the commissioners. Commissioner Fedorchek?
Well, good morning, everyone. It's good to be here. Just out of curiosity, are there any members of the public in the audience? Excellent. All right. Well, who knows? At some point, there may be some folks who show up. So we're always happy to have those folks here. Today, the focus, as in all of our hearings, is on orderly development. Our process is intended to pave the way for a balance between developing North Dakota's energy resources and doing so in an orderly way that minimizes impact to the environment and to the public who are living with this infrastructure. So that's our goal of these hearings. I look forward to a good conversation with the company about your plans to minimize impacts and to allow for that orderly development. It's always interesting with natural gas lines because our jurisdiction kicks in after the gas is processed and there's a market-ready product. So we have nothing to do with PSC with any of the siting of the gas part leading up to the plants. I think that's a distinction that the public probably doesn't necessarily understand, and some folks even in the industry don't have a clear understanding of that, but that's what our jurisdiction is. So in this case, we're looking at an NGL line and a relatively short one leading up to your export, One Oak's export line out of state. So I think it should be a pretty straightforward hearing. We'll have our standard questions about environmental impact and emergency response and all of those key issues, and look forward to a productive hearing. Thank you.
Commissioner Christman?
Well, since there's nobody here from the public at this point, I won't go into my usual spiel about the order of things and how we'll have all the public people sit and wait until the end. So I really don't have any other opening comments other than what Commissioner Fedorchak just said, so I'm ready to move on with the hearing.
Commissioner Kalk?
Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate One Oak being here today, but I'm wondering who's minding the store if you guys are all sitting out here, right? I've had a chance to tour your facilities throughout North Dakota a couple of different times. You've got a good operation going out there. I appreciate One Oak's commitment to reduce flaring and build the infrastructure needed to move this gas around. While this is relatively a small pipeline, it's big. I mean, think about it. It's only 4 miles, but 4 miles that critically moves from one area to another to do the processing that we have to do to reduce the flaring. So it's very important that we keep the infrastructure going. And to dovetail what Commissioner Fedorchak said, do it in a safe, responsible way. And so the questions that I ask, I think, John, you're well aware of what they're going to be. But just look forward to a good hearing. And if someone from the public does happen to show up, I see the media is here. I want to make sure they get their chance to say their piece, too. So thank you for coming and look forward to a good hearing.
Mr. Morrison, before you get started, can you just identify your witnesses in the area of their testimony?
Sure. Matthew Turpin will be speaking about the construction details, the design of the pipeline, and that type of engineering aspects. Travis Ashby will be the next witness, and he will be discussing primarily the safety regulations and community involvement, PHMSA requirements, that type of thing. And then Bill McCarthy, will be testifying as to the environmental and cultural review that went into the application.
You have an opening statement you'd like to make?
Very briefly. As the commissioners have indicated, this particular hearing deals with a 4-mile pipeline, and it's a natural gas liquids line that runs from the tailgate of a gas plant that's currently being constructed. It goes to a tie-in with a previously approved line. There has been an amendment, and I have pre-marked some exhibits. The exhibits I've pre-marked are the original application I've marked as Exhibit 1, the Volume 2 of the application, which is really the unredacted cultural resources report, I've marked that as Exhibit 1A, and then the June amendment I've marked as Exhibit 2, and the unredacted cultural resources report that goes along with the amendment I marked as Exhibit 2A. We would offer those exhibits at this time.
Mr. Schmidt, any objection?
No objection.
Okay. Exhibits 1, 1A, 2, and 2A will be admitted.
And before we begin with the witnesses, just to kind of clarify for everybody, the amendment that we filed in June really addresses an approximately 2-mile segment of the line, and it's an amendment at the tail end of the line. And if you want to see the amendment in Exhibit 2, which is the amendment, the June amendment, it's a map 2 of 2 under Appendix B. It's probably the best place to look, and it shows the original route of the map. The original route of the line, and then the reroute. And the witnesses will be describing that reroute and the reasons for it. But it's the easiest reference if you want to compare the original request and the amended request. And with that, I don't have any further comments, and we would call our first witness, who is Matthew Turpin.
Morning, Mr. Turpin. Before you testify, I'm required to give you an oath and advise you of the penalty for perjury in North Dakota. It's a Class C felony. It's punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, a maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. Being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Morrison.
Sir, would you state your name and tell us by whom you're employed and what capacity?
My name is Matt Turpin. I work for One Oak Partners. I'm a supervisor of projects for our Northern Business Unit, primarily pipeline construction, steel.
And can you give us your business address?
Business address is 100 West 5th Street, Tulsa, Oklahoma.
And have you testified before the Public Service Commission before?
No, I have not.
Can you just briefly summarize your post-high school education and your experience in the pipeline industry?
I have my bachelor's in science and mechanical engineering from the University of Oklahoma. I've been working in the industry for 9 years in various roles of project management and facilities and pipeline design.
And is the pipeline under discussion today, the Lonesome Creek NGL pipeline, one of your areas of responsibility with the company?
Yes, it is.
Can you briefly describe for the commission the pipeline that you're proposing to construct?
It is a 4 mile, 8 inch steel NGL line to move product from the Lonesome Creek plant into our Bakken gathering system. It has a MAOP of 1440 and capacity to move 30,000 barrels a day.
And when you said MAOP, that's maximum operating pressure, is that correct?
Maximum operating pressure, yes.
And the tie-in, is that what we've known as the Garden Creek NGL line?
Yes.
And can you tell us where that line, I mean, where that starts and where it ends up at?
The Garden Creek lateral starts at our tailgate of our Garden Creek processing plants, and it terminates into our Bakken pipeline.
And that is in Montana, is that correct?
In Montana.
And from there you have the ability to move these liquids either by pipeline or by rail, is that correct?
Yes.
And this is in connection with a plant that's being constructed at the present time, is that correct?
Yes, the Lonesome Creek.
Can you tell the commission when the anticipated completion date is for that pipeline, for that plant?
Anticipated completion is in December, early December of this year, 2015.
And this pipeline is necessary in order to bring that plant into an operating capacity, is that correct?
Yes.
You need to have the pipeline to move the liquids from the plant?
Yes.
What's the alternative to the pipeline if you were going to move liquids by some other method?
Alternative method to move liquids from the facility would be trucking at roughly a capacity of 95 trucks per day or some similar volume.
And would that put a severe strain on the local highways and improvements and that type of thing?
Yes.
Would also cause problems with the receipt points at the delivery point in Montana?
Yes.
Can you talk about valves and what other facilities are connected with the pipeline, where they'll be located?
Yes, we have isolation valves at the plant and our tie point in the Garden Creek line. Also at the Garden Creek tie point, we have a check valve which eliminates backflow from the Garden Creek lateral into the Lonesome Creek NGL line.
And can you describe the right-of-way that One Oak has acquired for the line in terms of width?
The right-of-way is a 100-foot construction right-of-way with a 50-foot permanent easement.
And is this being built simultaneously with another pipeline?
There is a 16-inch steel gathering line that feeds the processing plant that this line parallels for a short distance.
And construction on that pipeline is going to begin almost immediately, is that correct?
Yes.
And so there are reports of construction in the area. It's not construction on this line until we get the permit, but it would be construction on the 16-inch line.
Right.
And can you give us an estimate as to the cost of this pipeline?
This 4 mile project will cost around $6 million to complete.
And can you also give us some information on the construction schedule, when it's anticipated to begin and how long it will take to build the line?
Third quarter this year, we anticipate construction start and completion around December for the startup of the plant.
And I discussed earlier a reroute of the line. Are you familiar with the reasons the tail end of the line was rerouted?
Yes, we had a mutual agreement between the two landowners that the alternative route was better for all parties involved. It provided a less environmental impact, and it was a shorter route, which would mean better long-term operation for One Oak and ultimately a better economic impact to the project.
And I don't believe I have any further questions, witness, at this time.
Okay. Mr. Schmidt, you can cross-examine the witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. In your direct testimony, you talked about the valves and some of the other above-ground facilities. I'm going to start there. Can you just kind of give a brief description as what these structures will look like?
So there aren't any intermediate valves between the tailgate of the plant and the tie-in, but I'll start at the plant. At the plant, we have a meter facility where we measure the liquid's volume. And there is an isolation valve that is it's remotely operated and is being watched by our pipeline control group in Tulsa. At the tie point to the Garden Creek line is a isolation valve and a check valve. It's above ground pertinence inside the fence of an existing valve setting that we own on the asset.
So are there going to be any above ground facilities located along the proposed route, or would they all be at the bookends of the route?
They're at either ends. There's no intermediate.
In the application, it talks about how these receivers will facilitate the introduction of inline tools to perform various functions, from cleaning to integrity monitoring. Are you essentially talking about pigs in that sense?
Yes, pigs for operation and smart tools that inspect the integrity of the line.
Will there be any other monitoring practices used for this pipeline to ensure its integrity?
I think
Travis will cover that in more detail, but you can, I mean, want to give
from a construction perspective of the SCADA system, if to the extent you have knowledge of it, if it's really Travis's area, that's fine too.
We'll let Travis answer that question.
And maybe this will be more well suited for Travis also, but where will the pipeline be monitored from? Where will be the headquarters that monitors this pipeline?
I'll let Travis.
Yes. I can get, do you have an application in front of you? I want you to turn to the map on Appendix B. I believe it's the one that Mr. Morrison referred to earlier.
Which exhibit?
It would be the amended application, so it would be Exhibit 2. Then page 2 of that, the map 2 of 2, and Appendix B. If you'll look in there, there's a kind of a black and white map and a colorized map. I'm looking at the colorized map, and it's map 2 of 2. Now, there's two routes depicted on this map. Just to be clear, the route 1 Oak seeks a permit for is depicted in the darker line that's located to the east of the gray line on this map. Is that correct?
Yes.
You alluded to this a little bit in your direct testimony, but I want to hit on it just a little bit more. The amended application indicates that the route was changed due to landowner preferences. What concerns did that landowner have with the original route that caused you to change it?
I really don't know the question to that answer.
What other factors did One Oak take into consideration when rerouting this pipeline?
Well, shorter route. It was more constructible in aspect than the alternative route. You can see there's some rougher terrain on the southerly portion of the original.
This next question, if it's better suited by somebody else, just tell me. I'll table it. There's a landowner. Do you know anything about the landowner waivers that were obtained for this project?
No.
Okay. This pipeline, it states in the application that it's co-located with various other utility corridors. Can you just kind of give me a description of what other utility corridors that it's located with? Not necessarily the exact utility, but the type of utility?
I think you it's co-located with other midstream companies' assets. I'm not familiar with their, whether they're gas or oil gathering or...
Are there any specific risks located or associated with co-locating an NGL pipeline with these type of utilities?
No, that's a pretty common practice in our industry.
And are there any risks to the integrity of the actual NGL pipeline when you co-locate it with these types of utilities?
No, our integrity program will monitor that type of potential.
In the original application, it states that approximately 99.1% of the project is actually co-located within the existing utility corridor. However, it doesn't appear in the amended application as to how that number is affected by changing the location of this route. Do you know how much of the current proposed route is located within the existing utility corridor?
I don't know percentage-wise, but...
Is it close?
Yes, large majority.
I don't have any more questions for you.
Ms. Prescott, any questions?
None for this witness, Your Honor.
Okay. Commissioner Fedorchak?
Well, good morning. Thank you for being here and for being here for the first time in front of the commission. We always like to have new faces. Not that we don't like those who are around a lot, Bill McCarthy. But it's good to get new perspectives as well, so... Are you living in North Dakota?
No, I'm not. I live in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Okay. But you're the manager of this
I am the manager.
Project? So how often are you up here and working?
Once a month.
Okay. But do you have other folks on site who are really directly overseeing?
Yes, we have a construction management group that's headquartered out of Sydney, and there is a One Oak representative on the construction side as along with the project management side. There's and our environmental team and our safety team. So there's a hierarchy of One Oak bodies that support each and every project.
Mm-hmm. And Matthew, can you describe again your role both on this job and just in a broader sense with the company?
In a broader sense, I supervise a group of project managers that build steel pipelines in our northern business unit, that'd be Montana, North Dakota, Wyoming. And that group is headquartered out of Tulsa. And we work with our other divisions in the organization that support construction activities or environmental or safety. And right away.
Okay. All right. Can you remind me what the capacity of Lonesome Creek gas plant will be when it's completed?
The gas plant's 200 million.
Okay. And is this a totally new plant or an addition? I have a hard time keeping them.
This is a grassroots new construction project.
Okay. And when is it expected to be completed?
Early December.
Okay. Let's see here, you covered that. Can you tell me when you're constructing parallel to the other facility, the gathering line? Will those two projects be occurring simultaneously, and will the reclamation then occur kind of simultaneously as well?
Yes, reclamation on all projects associated is separate by a separate company that we contract out. So we plan to build the lines in kind of a tier-stepped, this one being the last line to be constructed. Any kind of work associated with this line will be delineated from the others so that we're not co-constructing the lines.
Okay, there won't be two lines going in at the same time. One line will be completed and then
right.
And reclaimed, and then the next one will...
Well, we'll fix the right-of-way to where it's reclaimable.
Yep.
And then with plans to come back through and install this 8-inch line and then do final restoration on both right-of-ways.
Okay. So can you just describe to me the process for handling the soil and how you will keep the topsoil and subsoil segregated throughout both of those construction processes and then preparing for final reclamation?
Yes, we'll dual spill piles, one with topsoil and one with the subsoil, and you go install your line, come back through, reclaim with the subsoil, and then put the topsoil back on.
Okay. If you're, how close would these two lines be?
I think they're 25 feet apart, center line.
So you have enough undisturbed material between them to keep the dual piles separate without putting it on the area that's already been disturbed?
Yes.
Okay. And then you'll come in when everything is, all the subsoil, topsoil is returned, it's graded, prepared for seeding, and you'll seed the whole lot together.
Yes.
And do you know, were the easements for both of these lines obtained at the same time so the landowners kind of knew this was what the process was going to be?
Yes, our land agents have been communicating our intentions for restoration and our plan on every agreement.
Okay. All right. In terms of the, you had a conversation with Mr. Schmidt about this, and I want to just follow up a little bit. The route changes. The original route was longer and had more bends in it. Why did you originally even consider that line? It seems like the one you settled on makes more sense.
Well, we have an existing 12-inch gas gathering line that's following that route.
Mm.
And we were trying to isolate it in the corridor, and we chose to shorten the route and move it across the street.
So the original route was a previous corridor for a line, an existing line?
Yes.
All right. The new route is the corridor for the... that is a lot quieter. so much nicer.
Mm-hmm.
The new route, is that the route, the whole route for the gathering line as well, the 16-inch gathering line? Okay.
Yes.
For the entire 4 miles, pretty much? Or in the area where you had the alternative route, that now is the area where you're paralleling the gathering line?
Yes, we meet back up with that line, that 12-inch gathering line. If you look on the left-hand side of the page of page 2,
mm-hmm.
Around mile marker 2.
Okay, that's where you meet, and then you follow it to the end?
Yes, all the way to the plant.
Very good. Tell me about the two features that I thought you originally in your first route were probably avoiding, those two wetlands. How will you cross those? And the wood, it looks like there's a fair amount of woodlands in the area on the left of that map. Wetlands and woodlands.
But their wetlands will be boring them, and I believe that is our intentions and what we have in our execution plan.
Okay.
And the trees, we will inventory on the 16 that's coming through there. That way we know what we'll have to replace when we come back with the 8-inch.
You pull the trees and and replace them elsewhere?
Yes.
All right. Can you tell me, you mentioned you weren't aware of any waivers. Who from the company can speak to the waivers? Occupied land or with occupied structures within 500 feet. Is that Bill or? Bill, okay. So in the application materials, the company mentioned that the landowner preference was to have this different route. It sounds to me that maybe it really was probably driven by the company. This is your preference and the landowner doesn't object to it?
We have a good relationship with both landowners on either of the routes, and between the three parties, it was mutually agreed that this would be better.
Okay. Very good. Tell me about the NGL stream. Can you describe it to me? What's in it?
It consists of all heavier hydrocarbon chains that come from the wet, unprocessed gas, pretty much ethane and heavier, so ethane, propane, butane, isobutane, gasolines, and we separate the methane and portion of the ethane out, and that goes into your residue natural gas line to your WBI or Northern Border, and then One Oak takes the NGL stream and transports it to market.
Okay. Just yesterday, I met with a North Dakota company that's trying to get ethane to build a facility here for cracking, and they can't do it. They can't get the ethane, which is counterintuitive to me, considering we have so much of it. Can you talk about your company's willingness at all to keep that ethane, some of this ethane here, to support those types of projects?
Well, I know we're working on a project with Vantage to supply them ethane for their customer.
Is that a North Dakota customer, do you know?
I think it's a Canadian customer.
Okay. How about keeping the ethane here? And, you know, this is going to your Garden Creek pipeline, which takes it out of state, and then it isn't available for use for these North Dakota type projects. Is One Oak open to keeping some of this ethane and NGLs in North Dakota, and what would be involved in making that happen?
Yes, we are, and I think a company would have to build a cracker or ethane facility that can use the ethane in the area first, and then you'd have a feedstock from our tailgate of our plants.
Okay. So from your perspective, you believe that One Oak is open to having that happen in North Dakota, not shipping this out of state?
And that's a commercially driven kind of question that I'm probably not the expert in.
You're the pipeline builder.
I build pipelines.
Okay. Okay. If there's somebody who you think I should direct that kind of a question to or can get me the name for, I would be interested in that, even in a break or whatever.
I don't have anybody here today, but we can get you the name of a contact.
Okay.
I mean, I think it's part of this hearing, but we can get you the name of a contact to talk to.
Thanks. Appreciate that, John. Okay. Waivers. Tell me, are there any operational risks of an NGL pipeline that are different from other lines? Or should we direct that to the Travis?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. Okay, I think that concludes my questions. Thank you, Matthew.
All right.
Commissioner Christman?
Thanks, Your Honor. I thought I had a whole list of questions, but the chairman got most of them answered here for me. The There's just a couple pieces I got to put together. This seemed so backwards to what we're used to, where the company comes in with an application that has kind of a circuitous route, and then the amendment at the request of the landowners is to straighten it out. Usually it's the exact opposite. So I understand now that the reason that you had the original application was because that would follow an existing corridor, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so, and you're dealing with the same landowners in either event. They own both the original route and the new route?
No.
Well, it's different landowners?
Different landowners.
But either one, you have an easement to go either way?
We don't have an easement. We didn't agree to an easement with the original route landowner. We went to another landowner and obtained an easement for these two lines.
In the original application, it said all easements have been acquired.
I'm not familiar with that.
Okay.
Detail.
You have the application in front of you yet?
Yes.
Look on page 34 in section 7.
Which one? This one? What appendix?
The section 7 tab. Okay. And then it's the first page of that section. It's page number 34 on the bottom, and then the last sentence of section 7.1.
Yes. You want me to read it?
Well, but that had to do with the original route, correct?
Right.
So that easement is in place. And now I'm understanding you also have the easement in place for the new route?
I'm not completely familiar if it could be. If, I wish our right-of-way agent was here that would have that information.
Okay. But to be clear, you do have the easement in place for the new route?
Yes.
That's proposed. Okay. And the next witness will answer the questions as far as the occupied residences, right?
Right.
Okay. I have no other questions. Thank you, though.
Commissioner Kolk?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Matt, for your testimony. And you said it was your first time testifying, but you handled it perfectly. If you not only don't know the answer, don't try to speculate, just pass it along. Some witnesses come out and they try to answer every question, and it's like then the next witness comes up and tries to correct what the first witness says. So thank you for just walking through it. I don't have a lot of questions. Just the more of it's more just to grow my knowledge base about natural gas liquids. We do a lot of crude pipelines, but not so much on NGLs. Commissioner Fedorchuk asked you about the breakup of the gas or the liquids, but tell me this. You said 30,000 barrels per day. So NGLs are measured in barrels per day, but when it's gas, it's cubic feet. How do I compare those units? Or you, don't I?
Well, you can do like a calculation to go from gas to liquid in density and volume, but the NGL stream is in a liquid state. Whereas, and that's measured by barrels. And then the residue gas is in a gas state with no liquid, so you'll measure that
in the cubic
volume
feet.
In cubic feet.
So is there ever, so the barrels per day for natural the liquids is the same as a barrel for crude, 42 gallons?
Yes.
And then is there a temperature where this liquid stream would become gas?
It's vapor pressure. And each component has a different vapor pressure at atmospheric temperature.
So if there was the next witness, I guess we'll talk about leaks, but that's kind of a cue up, is if it does have a leak, how does the gas break out? Is it, does one go first, and does it become, that's one of the questions I think will be different than we probably asked in our crude hearings.
The lighter end hydrocarbon chains will vaporize first, and your heaviers will last.
Sure, okay. And then the sizing of the pipeline, we've seen, you talked about a 16-inch gathering line, which is non-jurisdictional, but this is an 8-inch jurisdictional pipeline. Is this big enough? How do you, we've seen a lot of cases where it get built an 8-inch and they'll come back and put another one right next to it.
Our project's development group has run various scenarios. This is for volumes and forecasted projects. This is such a short run, and we don't foresee any tie-ins to this line or facilities upstream that would add additional barrels or volume.
So if you want to grow the size of the plant, how are you going to do that?
Well, the plant is, the line is big enough for another plant, a mirrored plant.
Okay. So the 30,000 barrels per day, that can be increased to what would be the max of that this pipeline could move? Just roughly.
I think the 30,000 is equivalent to 400 million cubic feet.
Okay.
This line will not be flowing 30,000 barrels on.
Got it. That makes sense then. And then let's see here. I believe the... I believe that's it. Thank you.
Mr. Morrison, any follow-up questions?
Just let me ask a question and see if you agree with my understanding of where we are in the easements. I mean, you do have an easement from the owner on the original route for the 12-inch line that's in place. Is that correct?
For the 12-inch.
And you were in negotiations with that landowner to expand that easement to accommodate additional lines. Is that correct?
Yes.
And in the process of that is when it was decided mutually between the parties, it was best to move it across the street and deal with the other landowner. Is that
yes.
An accurate understanding?
Yes.
And just to clarify again, too, it is your intention to do the inventory of all the trees when you construct the 16-inch line. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so if that 16-inch line were later to be converted to a jurisdictional purpose, you will have fulfilled all the commission requirements to come back in and do that conversion at that point in time?
Yes.
No further questions.
Mr. Schmidt?
Anything further, Ms. Prescott?
Yes, Your Honor. So the maximum capacity is 30,000 barrels. What's your expected capacity?
Expected production upon completion
right.
of the Lonesome Creek plant? Roughly half that.
Okay. And you're talking about winter construction or completion in December, right?
Well, we'd like to align completion of the project with, we would like to be done with this project as soon as possible. So our current schedule has completion in the beginning of November. Okay. We have schedule contingency with the startup of the plant where if something drove the schedule longer, then we have a month.
Okay. No other questions, Your Honor?
Commissioner Fedorchak?
Other questions? Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Christman?
No other questions.
Commissioner Kolk?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, John, for your follow-up, because that 16-inch gathering line, that's what was tripping in my head, that you got to be thinking about using that down the road. So thank you for that line of questions.
Anything further, Mr. Morrison, for this witness?
Nothing further.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Turpin.
Thanks.
And you can call your next witness.
Next witness will be Travis Ashby.
Mr. Ashby, before you begin your testimony, I'm required to give you an oath, and I need to advise you of the penalty for perjury in North Dakota. It's a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. And being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay, go ahead.
Travis, will you state your name for the record and tell us by whom you're employed?
Travis Ashby, last name's A-S-H-B-Y. I'm employed by One Oak Partners as a regulatory and compliance specialist in the Tulsa office.
And can you give us your business address in Tulsa?
It's 100 West 5th Street, Tulsa, Oklahoma.
And have you previously testified for this commission before?
I have not.
Can you just briefly review for us your educational and professional background?
Sure. So I have a Bachelor's of Science from Louisiana Tech University in Professional Aviation and have a little over 10 years of experience in the midstream business, primarily in the areas of regulatory compliance and pipeline safety.
And one of your areas of responsibility with the company is this particular pipeline, is that correct?
Correct.
And you're familiar with the proposed pipeline and the regulation of that pipeline?
Yes, sir.
Can you describe for the commission the safety features that will be included in the construction of this pipeline?
Sure. So part of the safety features is the monitoring of the pipeline by our control center in Tulsa. There will be certain data points monitored on the pipeline, such as flow, temperature, pressure, density. That's monitored continuously 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by our control center in Tulsa. In addition to that, we have isolation valves, one at the upstream of the pipeline, the tailgate of the plant. That's can be a remotely operated valve, which can be actuated at any time as if needed from our control center in Tulsa. And then on the downstream, the tie into Garden Creek, we have a manually operated isolation valve with a automatic isolation valve just up of that, which is a check valve.
And that check valve then would prevent any other fluids from coming out of the Garden Creek line and backing into this line.
Correct.
So if you shut down the valve at the plant end, you've isolated all the fluids in the pipeline. Is that
correct?
And at 4 miles, is that all the isolation valves that are required by industry standards and by PHMSA?
Yes.
And is this a PHMSA-regulated line?
It will be, correct.
And can you describe for the commission the plans you have for inspection and monitoring of the pipeline after it's constructed?
Sure. So this pipeline will follow our operations and maintenance manual that we have developed for all of our pipeline systems. It'll include things like aerial patrol of the pipeline 26 times per year. We do inspections on the isolation valves to make sure they work, maintain them if necessary. Those are inspected twice a year. The shutdown device and the safety protectant is inspected twice a year. We have a cathodic protection monitoring system that will be included in this pipeline. And then the integrity management plan or the ongoing kind of pigs that were talked about earlier will also be a part.
And PHMSA sets standards for all of these inspection plans. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And your plans will meet or exceed PHMSA standards.
Yes,
is that
sir.
Correct? And have you also, and so you do have an emergency response plan that you've formulated in accordance with PHMSA?
We do.
And have those plans been shared with the McKenzie County Emergency Manager?
They have.
And do you coordinate with that department on a regular basis?
Correct. Part of that coordination is our participation in the North Dakota Pipeline Association, our membership in that association, where they coordinate face-to-face liaison meetings at least annually between operators and the emergency officials, kind of give you a chance to meet them for our first responders on the ground, to meet the emergency officials and exchange information and things like that.
And do you also conduct drills on a regular basis?
Correct. We'll do drills at least annually to you know, basically, you know, check the performance of our emergency personnel to make sure they understand. We do training on the plan, and then kind of after the training would be drills to check their performance, make sure emergency numbers work and things like that.
Following up on a question, Commissioner Colcat, for the earlier witness, can you maybe describe what would happen to the fluids or the liquids if you did have a break in this line, if you had a spill?
Sure. So kind of as Mr. Turpin said, the components in this pipeline are a string of hydrocarbons going from, you know, ethane being the lightest to natural gasolines or C5 pentanes plus being heavier. And when they're held under pressure, they're a liquid. But as they leave pressure, the vast majority of these, starting with kind of priority list from the lighter ends, the ethanes down, vaporize and turn into a gas. So you don't have the liquid presence that you do with an oil line, as you may be more familiar with.
And eventually all of it would essentially evaporate, is that correct?
Correct. The heavier ends might hang around a little bit longer, but eventually they'll all weather off like a gasoline type would. But those are the smallest percentage. The heavier ends are the smallest percentage of the component stream.
And with that, I don't believe I have any further questions, this witness.
Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you, Your Honor. You talked about some of the pipeline testing during your direct. I just want to hit on that a little bit. How often will the pipeline integrity be tested on this line?
So this pipeline will fit into our pipeline integrity management program, and in that program they look at the threats for the pipeline, and they get it's a lot of data integration that they take in to determine how frequently is it inspected, what tools will they run, you know, what threats are they looking for. And I don't have the specifics of what all that will be, but I I think typically it's in the 3 to 5 year range we'll run high-tech inspection pigs through the pipeline.
And what's the expected lifespan of this pipeline?
I don't think I can answer that.
You stated that a lot of the materials within this pipeline would just evaporate if there was a spill. Is that correct?
They turn to a gas, a vapor.
And so what are really the main risks that are associated with an NGL spill?
So, maybe a better term would be an NGL release. So you release it from the pipeline, and then you do have, when it releases, it's heavier than air, so it does tend to stay, low to the ground, and can maybe sometimes essentially pull in low-lying areas. So you do have a flammability risk. That low-lying hydrocarbons will form a vapor cloud. It's a visible, kind of like a white cloud type feature that will eventually dissipate, and the dissipation time kind of depends on really the weather, what's the temperature, what's the wind doing, things like that.
What if that vapor cloud was to be inhaled by a human or an animal? Would there be adverse effects to that person or animal in that event?
Sure. I don't think we would describe it as toxic, but in the sense that it's not breathable oxygen, there would be some adverse effects with that, correct?
And what would those adverse effects be? Do you have any idea?
No, I don't think I could speak to the specifics other than it's not it'd be like breathing any air that's not suitable for breathing.
How long does it take for a cloud like that to dissipate?
It varies. It varies pretty heavily dependent on the temperature. If it's an 80 degree day, you'd see it dissipate, pretty darn quick. If it's 0 degrees outside, it might be a couple of hours. Of course, the wind also having a pretty big role to play in that. So it's hard to say exactly.
Given the location of this proposed pipeline, how long would it take for first responders to get out and deal with a type of leak or spill, or however you want to classify it?
Release? Sure. So I think kind of first is that it will be monitored 24 hours a day, 7 days a week by our control center in Tulsa, and they have the ability at any time to close valves to basically isolate the section. We do have the individual who will be specifically responsible for this pipeline lives in Watford City, so his proximity is close. And then One Oak has a larger presence in the area with employees at the plant and with other business units. And many times those employees are also trained to the same operator qualification standards that the employee that's specifically responsible for this line is.
Has One Oak taken any steps with the local government agencies on how to handle an NGL type of issue as opposed to like a crude issue or something like that?
Sure. So a part of the one of the associations I mentioned earlier, the North Dakota Pipeline Association, the training materials that are included in that we'll talk about the NGL versus gas versus oil and the different risks associated with those, and then also some of the literature that we mail out to emergency officials annually and to other stakeholders describes proper response for a natural gas liquid release.
How about with regard to the landowners which this pipeline will run across? Are they educated on the risks associated with an NGL release on their property?
Sure. The brochures or the mailings that we do to the emergency responders, we have a similar but different kind of targeted towards affected public is the stakeholder audience, we call them. They will also be sent that information.
I have nothing further.
Ms. Prescott?
No, Your Honor.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
Thank you, Travis. Appreciate you being here. I don't know that you've testified either.
I have not.
The commission. Okay. Got a new group at One Oak. okay, just a few follow-up questions on the safety issues. The fact that the in a release, the vapors sort of pool close to the ground, I would assume that presents a flammability risk.
That is correct.
How can you describe that? Would a spark ignite an explosion, or how flammable is this stuff when it releases?
So it could. I mean, this is a hydrocarbon. That's why we harvest it from the ground for its, the flammability purposes it has. The instructions that we give through our emergency training and stuff like that is to move away from the vapor cloud that you see, right, crosswind or upwind, to just get away from it, and to remove ignition sources. So you don't start a vehicle to run away from it. You don't make cell phone calls, you know. So we train to eliminate the ignition source. But if you did have an ignition source with the right, the right explosive threshold of, you know, oxygen and the fuel, then you could have a fire.
Is it odorized? Can people smell this?
It does not have an added odorant such as a mercaptan like you see in some like distribution gas pipelines. That being said, there could be some natural odor with it that could be noticed by people.
What would be the best way to notice an NGL leak?
Visibly, you'll be able to visibly see a frost ball or a vapor cloud, a white vapor cloud on the ground.
Okay. And in your monitoring systems, how do you detect leaks? Is it a drop in pressure, or describe what you guys can pick up and at what level of detail does your monitoring system pick up?
So there's several monitoring systems. One would be aerial patrol, for instance. You know, we fly our pipelines. The pods are trained to look for signs of a leak, such as dead vegetation or an ice ball on the ground or something like that, or a vapor cloud. They're also looking for other things such as third-party damage, encroachment on the right-of-way, and things like that. Our pipeline control center in Tulsa being another form of monitoring where they're looking at pressure and volume and temperature and things like that. And they have alarms set up that can alarm them if things are out of normal state of operations that they could then respond to.
So the volume in and volume out on an NGL line is tracked?
On this line, for instance, there will be at the upstream, you'll have volume measurement on the upstream in addition to pressure and temperature. On the downstream, you'll have pressure only. So we there's not actually volume monitoring going out. So they'll be looking at pressure on both ends.
So pressure from the 24/7 monitoring, which is the monitoring that's going to find things the fastest, right? Find a problem the quickest.
Correct.
The aerial patrol is great, but it could have gone on for 10 days or since the last patrol before you found a leak that way.
Correct.
So in the 24/7 monitoring, it's pressure drops. Pressure changes.
Yes.
How, at what level of detail do the monitors pick that up? And what would ignite an alarm, for example?
So the process that we'll go through as we're working on the startup of this pipeline is looking at the steady state operations, and we have a whole team of people who do leak detection monitoring. And I understand enough about it to understand that it's a complex with computer systems and algorithms, and so I'm probably not the best person to quantify an exact, you know, leak amount or threshold that we might be able to pick up. It's one of the reasons we have more than one form of monitoring, right? We don't just rely on SCADA. We also do patrols because there are some leaks that you might find on an airplane that may be so small that might be more difficult to pick up through a SCADA system.
Okay. So the smaller leaks are probably the ones that you detect from air.
Possibly, yes.
Okay. You talked about the heavier components being sort of the last to evaporate, but there's more lighter components in this. Can you give me a percentage? What percent of the contents is the lighter components, like ethane, et cetera?
Sure. So I think as a general rule, and it kind of varies by the gas stream in the plant and whether or not the plant's in ethane rejection or recovery mode. But I think around 10% would be the volume that we would say would be the heavier ends that would take a little bit longer to weather off or evaporate.
Okay, so then in terms of, this is my last question, seems one of the greatest risks for this line would be third-party strike. Could you ignite an explosion in an NGL line with a third-party strike?
So I agree with your assessment. I think as an industry, third-party damage is probably the largest threat we face, and we spend a lot of time and money as a company and as an industry working against that threat. And to answer your question, if you have a third-party strike and there's a release of the product, you have the same threats that would recur for any type of release, right? So you have flammable substance being exposed to atmosphere and potential ignition sources.
Mm-hmm. Is it less in an NGL versus natural gas line from like a strike causing an explosion?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. All right. Just a little bit of education myself. Sure. that's all my questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Chrisman?
It seems like everything's kind of upside down for me here today. First, I was puzzled why the original route was long and windy, and the subsequent route is straight, and I appreciate Mr. Morrison's follow-up questions, so I finally was able to understand that. And now, contrary to usual, usually I'm asking people to simplify things, but I want you to go into a little more detail on something. So once again, I'm upside down.
But okay.
You said that the lighter components would vaporize more quickly and the heavier components would hang around a while longer. Are we talking seconds and minutes, or are we talking days and weeks? Or say it's a cold winter day and it's not windy. What kind of time frame are we talking about to vaporize generally?
Sure. So I think you hit on one of the keys to it, right? The weather and the atmospheric conditions has a large impact on how long any of the components, but particularly the heavier ones, will stay around. And with respect to the vapor cloud, I'd mentioned, you know, maybe a couple hours if it were a cold day. With respect to any of the heavies that may kind of impact the soil and how long those might stay around, I don't know that I can quantify an answer for you on that. I don't know. I don't think I can give you an answer on that.
Let me ask it this way. If there's a release on a chillier day and it's in a low area, in an hour or two, is it conceivable that you come by and there's a pond of the heavier liquids setting on the ground? Or in hours, will it all be vaporized?
Yeah, I think in that scenario, again, kind of hesitant to give exacts, but I wouldn't use the word pond. I mean, I don't think, again, with the smaller percentage of this that would be the heavies, you just don't see that liquid hold up that you see with a liquid line. So there may be some entrained stuff that's on the surface, or maybe a little bit entrained in the soil. But it evaporates, I would say, fairly quickly still.
Okay. And then my last question is, when you fly this, and you had mentioned watching for dead vegetation or a frost ball. So in the winter, when all the vegetation appears dead and the whole state looks like a frost ball, probably from the air.
Sure.
What do you really see if there's a leak in the winter?
So I think in the winter, you're obviously looking for different things than you would be in the summer, right? You might not catch the dead vegetation or the frost, but you're looking maybe more so for any other unusual, anything unusual that the pilot would report, but probably more so third-party damage threat is maybe the better threat the pilot picks up in the winter than in the rest of the year.
I guess it wasn't my last question. Did I understand you right? The vapor clouds, if there was a release, tend to hang in the low areas, correct?
That's correct. The components are heavier than air.
And is that a visible cloud? Like, would someone see that from the air?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you. No other questions.
Commissioner Kalk?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Travis, for your testimony and your follow-up questions. I'm always thinking back to my Marine Corps days when we used to do nuclear, chemical, and biological spill response. It's all mapped out on wind and temperature, and there's no way you can answer any of these questions directly because everyone is going to have so many sets of variables. The general knowledge is you've got the plan that goes into PHMSA, and they'll probably have you walk through all these different scenarios is what I'm guessing.
Yes.
So if you had that final PHMSA plan, you could probably answer all these questions for us, but that's probably being worked right now.
The plan that we're incorporating this line is a plan that is already in effect, basically, you know, has been audited by PHMSA, and so we'll be incorporating that into this plan.
Because that's what I was kind of thinking, is the plan that's already on file for the actual plant itself is probably much more complex and robust than what's going to be required for this four-mile pipeline.
Yes, there will be a different plan for the plant than from the pipeline.
And I would guess that the higher risk is probably from the plant itself and the proximity than this pipeline.
You may be right. I don't know if I'd want to speculate as to that.
I'm just kind of throwing it out there.
Sure.
I do have a question, though, and I know it's not for this hearing, but is the 16-inch gathering line, is that how is that different in monitoring and safety than this 8-inch interstate jurisdictional line, if there is any differences?
You know, I don't with my responsibilities, it's been mainly on the liquid pipeline side within One Oak, so I'm not probably the right person to answer that question.
Okay. And I believe that was it. Thank you. Oh, when did you notify PHMSA that this would go into operation? Or when will you notify PHMSA that this will go into operation?
So PHMSA, this line, actually, PHMSA has notification requirements. To simplify it a little bit, it's 10 miles or $10 million. So this line didn't particularly require an official notification to PHMSA. However, PHMSA is aware of it. We've been in communication with PHMSA. They're planning on inspecting this pipeline.
I didn't know there was a minimum level. Okay, 10 miles or $10 million. If it's below that, they don't need to be notified?
Generally, there are maybe a couple other components, but that's generally the thresholds.
So the construction oversight for PHMSA, they don't look at pipelines less than 10 miles?
They're looking at this one. They will look at this one. We've been in coordination with them. How they prioritize their construction,
it's up to them.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Mr. Morrison, any follow-up?
No follow-up.
Mr. Schmidt?
Nothing further.
Ms. Prescott?
No, Your Honor.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
No more questions, Your Honor.
Commissioner Christman? Commissioner Culp? Okay. Thank you. I think we'll break for about 10 minutes before the next witness.